Welcome to Politics Weekly. I am Allegra Stratton. Joining me today to munch through the last week of political fodder, we have a top team of Guardian minds. We have Anne Perkins, who I think is the Katharine Hepburn of the Guardian. Good morning, Anne. Will Woodward, who's our playing manager, who was on the front page yesterday writing about Labour polls, which we're going to talk about later. And we also have Mike White in Westminster, who I regard to be the Jack Lemmon of the Guardian. Hello, Mike.
Hello there. You're forgiven. He's a good guy.
Now listen, David Cameron called Brown a phony. Will, hit or miss?
He is a phony, we're all phonies. Brown is a decent guy.
But it was rude.
Of course, it was incredibly rude, given that he made the remark on the back of some actually rather nice comments Brown had made about Cameron. But, you know, there's an election on.
Mike, what do you think over there?
I think Cameron noted in the Guardian's interview with Gordon Brown earlier this week that he had talked movingly about the death of Ivan Cameron, something we all know he understands, and said he didn't much like the Punch and Judy, you quote me, I quote you stuff.
Yeah.
And then he was doing it again. Well, of course, you have to do it. I mean, none of them like that terrible session, but they're sort of trapped in it. And even when they try to get out of it, it comes back. It's a kind of red meat, which I don't know whether the voters want it. They say they don't, but it's sort of like mud wrestling, but the media certainly likes it.
Final word to you, Anne.
You know, just look at the posts after Martin Kettle's assessment of PMQs, and nobody outside bubble notices it anymore.
This week, The Guardian has been running a series called Can Labour Win? It's looking at the party's election chances, and you know what? It found slightly surprising optimism. Mike, you went up to Leeds, didn't you? Why, oh why, did you go there?
Well, the Pennines, both sides of the Pennines, Lancashire side and Yorkshire side, there are a lot of marginals which swing over a period. And, of course, there's a three-way dimension in Yorkshire too, Lib, Tory, Labour. So it's interesting territory.
Well, Mike, let's hear from some of the people you met.
Which party do you normally vote for?
In the past, Labour.
Yeah. So you're ex-Labour voter? You wouldn't vote Labour next time, is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't to the next election, no.
Is that about the recession or about Gordon Brown, or just that time for a change?
The recession and Gordon Brown, really.
There's just an air of doom and gloom with the economy at the moment in Europe.
To blame the bankers or the government?
I think both. At a time when we were doing well, the money should have been invested a lot better than it has been, and that there was a lot of greedy speculators out there, and chance of some quick money to be made, and I think that's really where it all stems from.
We've bumped into a veteran Labour activist called Arthur Giles, who has views on these things, and I'm just going to have a few words with him.
We're fighting elections now.
This is the by-election on the other side of the city, or do you mean...
We're fighting that, but we're fighting local elections and the general election now. We fight all the time. We leaflet all the time, we knock on doors all the time. Not just when there's a by-election. In our own constituency of Putsy, which you've come to visit, that's exactly what we're doing.
And Pudsey's next door, and it's the sort of seat you could lose, isn't it?
Yes.
The Tories have got their eye on Pudsey.
Indeed it is, and it's seen as a very important seat.
When you're knocking on the door in Pudsey at the moment with people who are known to be Labour supporters in the past, what's the reaction like? What are they saying?
We're surprised, to be honest, because they're fairly consistent in terms of wanting to continue to support us. Quite recently, we attached a kind of questionnaire to our leaflet. At least 97% weren't necessarily in favour, but weren't against.
Mike, were you surprised by what you found?
Well, I spoke to activists like Mr. Giles, you heard there, but also in the city centre. It's an old device of mine, other people do it too. You just stand there in the street getting people to talk to you. They're all busy, they're shopping. Most of them, of course, people in the city centre, any city centre, are likely to be employed and busy. So not typical of people sitting at home having lost their job. But I was struck by two things. One, there wasn't a sort of savage hostility towards the government. I spoke to a bloke outside Asda, who'd just come out from the Asda HQ, obviously well-dressed professional man. Whose fault is it? Well, you know, the government hasn't done badly in a difficult situation. Everybody's in a pickle. Are you a Labour voter? No, I've never voted Labour. And there was a lack of animus against
Labour. A reasonable man.
And also, well, and it was more than that. People didn't start saying that David Cameron, I fancy him. And you thought, well, maybe, as the Guardian poll later in the week suggested, maybe it is still to play for. It isn't the done deal, seal the deal, all these phrases people use. So I'm slightly surprised to find that.
But Will, that was Leeds. What about the rest of the country? Obviously, Mike didn't do a round trip, but do you sense it's applicable?
Well, the ICM poll the Guardian published this week was you know, very difficult for Labour. A huge 12-point lead, same as last month. David Cameron extends his personal lead over Brown. A massive figure. When people are asked to say whether they believe in time for a change or stick with Labour, they're 70% time for a change, 25% stick with Labour, including a lot of Labour voters. And yet, there's just this sense out there that if it can be made an election about the economy and only the economy, and there are enough signs by the time we get to polling day, which, you know, we've been wrong on this before, but really does feel like it is going to be May or June next year, then they've got a chance. No more than that. I would guess it's kind of 1 in 5. Are we talking those sort of, you know, Labour have got a kind of 5-to-1 chance of winning?
And it sort of goes against what I sometimes hear, which is if we can only start talking about education and health, then we get a bounce, is what Labour said. You think fight on the economy or fight on other things?
I think probably fight on the economy, but I think one of the problems you always get with elections is that on the whole, they're not kind of won and lost on particular things. And we all know that they're won and lost arguably years in advance, which makes the economy or even turning it around at this point hard. But you don't feel, it doesn't feel now like it felt in 94, 95, 96. You don't feel that the government's completely blown it. And nor do you feel that, although, you know, Cameron's allowed people to talk about the Tories again, nor do you feel he's kind of riding this, surfing this great wave of popular enthusiasm the way Blair did. It just doesn't feel like that. And it doesn't, I mean, I can't really quite remember the run-up to 79, but you don't get the sense that there's a kind of political watershed approaching, even though this is probably a seminal an election to win as 79
but you,
was.
You mentioned Martin Kettle's piece where he argued, you know, he thinks it's slightly overdone, this kind of, you know, it doesn't feel like mid-90s, therefore Cameron can't be about to win. And actually in that piece, he sort of says he's revising that because of the phony comment. But do you think we run the risk sometimes of overdoing 96?
I think there's always a danger of, you know, reading backwards or reading forwards from history and misunderstanding what you're reading and saying if that happened, then that therefore the next thing happened. I think you have to keep returning to it, not least because of the kind of sort of the way the political cycle seems to be developing, which is long periods of single party government. You know, this is the second time we've had a series of administrations that have lasted more than 10 years. So I think something has happened, and I think you do need a big gear change to shift the incumbent party.
Mike, arguably, wouldn't it be great for Labour if they lost the next election, give the Tories something to clean up, Tories wouldn't manage and Labour might be back within 5 years?
Well, that's sort of rational thing. I've never met a politician yet who wants to lose an election or says, glad we lost that one. Neil Kinnock, after 92, I said what you've just said. Yeah. God, you were lucky to lose that one. I mean, they had the whole crisis of the of falling out of the European monetary system, as it then was. And he then got into a long Neil Kinnock explanation as to why they'd have done it differently. They'd have avoided the Black Wednesday crisis. And that's how politicians think. To be in politics, you've got to be an eternal optimist and very tough and very resilient. And so, no, of course, they don't want to lose. Some of them wouldn't mind because they're tired, but others will say, no, you read it in the Hazel Blair stuff in the Guardian feature yesterday. You know, Little Miss Sunshine, Nick Watt calls her, and, you know, she's got 6 or 7 reasons why Labour's got to win. Be united, find a message. Yeah.
Will, unemployment figures hit the poisonous, the toxic 2 million. That's what Cameron should have hammered home to Brown yesterday, and arguably by going for phony he missed it.
Well, he sort of started on that, didn't he? And then he kind of ran away with himself.
But isn't that the moment where you jump up and down on the grave of a dying government? You don't have people sitting in rooms like this questioning your language.
It was a mistake, you know. It was a blunder. You know,
you're shaking your head, Anne.
Only because I think it's only 20-something years since the Tories were presiding over the most horrendous unemployment figures, and there are far too many voters who can remember that and who experienced that. For Cameron to sound authentic on unemployment, just on unemployment, yes, perhaps on the economy, but not just on unemployment. I just think that the Tories have, you know, that's a mountain that I doubt they'll ever be able to climb.
But Mike, do you think that's fair? Do you think it's just political journalists who constantly rake through the annals of history and that most voters are not constantly reminded of Thatcher, etc.?
Well, there'll be people voting this time who weren't born when Margaret Thatcher was pushed under the bus in Westminster in 1990, wasn't it, November? One can be over-rational. I agree with everybody who said it's all about the economy. That's what every conversation, in a way unusual in my lifetime, except sort of major international crises or the fall of the Berlin Wall, it's the economy, it's the economy. Although interesting, on some issues, Labour's clawing it back. The Staffordshire health crisis this week is unusual because Labour's now back ahead in the polls on the NHS. All that money is finally making a difference. You don't discount that lightly because, of course, if you lose a Labour issue like the NHS, you're in trouble. But equally against that, never underestimate the odd, incoherent feeling people have time for a change. Send in democracy's removal van, let the other lot see if they can do better.
Will, every single word of the Can Labour Win series went through your hands. Very quickly, cause for optimism if you're a Labour supporter, or probably not?
I think it showed you've got one. They've got one card. There's a great line in the Philip Gould review in the Statesman this week, where Brown says the great thing, the one thing about Tony Blair is you always knew where he was going. And I don't think you can make the same claim for Brown. It really is the economy or bust.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you can read all of our copy on our website. There's also our columnist ideas for the next party manifesto, and also that exclusive interview with GB. Well, one way for Labour to please its heartlands would be to get rid of the bomb or nuclear warhead stockpiles that we have. This week we heard from Gordon that if Barack Obama and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev show willing, he too will scale back his stockpile. It all felt a little bit previous. Mike, you must have heard this all before.
Afraid so. It really does make you feel your age, the whole nuclear business. It was a time when, you know, people, as it were, when I was your age, we all had to know this stuff. There was a whole nuclear theology about mutually assured destruction and no first strike and multiple independently targeted re-entry vehicles.
MAD was the first political principle my dad taught me, actually.
Was it indeed? And Dr. Strangelove, that great Peter Sellers film. Anyway, that all went away and, you know, they threw away vast quantities of stockpile, the superpowers, who had 25,000 warheads each. So that's a figure which has stuck in my brain for 20 years. And they're down to much less, and they throw away their out-of-dated stuff because nobody ever gets a chance, of course, to use this stuff. It's all theory. Gordon Brown said this week where he and Tony Blair set this up before the 2005 election. I remember them doing it in a primary school press conference in South London, Wimbledon, I think, on a sunny morning. You could see them saying, we're going to do the nuclear. And here is Tony. I'm helping Gordon out for the future by associating us both with this to renew a Trident. The rivets are coming out of the submarines. They've been on the shore of the Atlantic banging into French submarines for years now. And the theory for doing it, the only important thing I want to say, because is that the question is, do the Europeans give up their nuclear weapons and rely wholly on the United States? We used to called decoupling. What if the Americans aren't interested in saving us from the Russians or whoever it is? Maybe it's the Turks when they get fed up with joining the EU. And that was always the issue. We need our own because at the end of the day, the Americans might let us down. And that's where we still are.
And I was talking to Shirley Williams, who advises Brown on this stuff, and she was saying, you know, she's been telling him there is a very real danger. You do not have a generation that remember the threat acutely.
From the moment that decision was taken, it struck me as the most extraordinary hostage to fortune. What an extreme kind of throwback to a response to a historic, disastrous era for Labour, wrestling with the whole disarmament thing. But to keep fighting that battle in the 21st century seemed to me a bizarre call, and in the current economic context, it seems to be completely unsustainable.
Yeah, Trident's 20 billion.
Which side is Anne on there? Sorry, I'm not being tricky.
I think that Brown was wrong. Okay. Blair and Brown were wrong to commit to renew.
Okay. Will, do you remember the Mansion House speech? I mean, I was thinking, what do we know about Gordon and the bomb? And I was going, and there was that Mansion House speech about the economy. He was Chancellor, and he slipped in a line about, and we'll keep our deterrent. Is it positioning for Gordon?
I have no idea, but now he's committed to spending £20 billion on four new submarines in a recession.
And investing in British industry and skills is what you
maybe
really mean.
Maybe this is as indulgent as you know, banging on about choice all the time, and people want to pare back now and spend the money on the necessaries. And maybe what this speech has thrown up is, No, is it absolutely necessary?
But it's generational difference is what it's thrown up here.
What, between you and Will?
Partly that. And alas and alack, the defence industry is a manufacturing industry where we still do pretty well and export a lot. It's horrible, but that's where we are. So it isn't wasting $20 billion. It's building submarines and retaining skills base. It's really important. It's horrible, but it's true.
That's always been the dilemma for Labour on defence, hasn't it? That it's jobs where jobs are really badly needed and they're quality jobs.
Yeah.
And I mean, Obama's talking about going back to 1,000. If Medvedev goes back to 1,000, surely the point about, you know, the MAD, etc., is you just go back to zero.
But there's only ever been a kind of internal logic to this kind of debate. What I think is really much more interesting is what this says about where Brown thinks this kind of new world order. Mm. And we're not just talking defence here. We're obviously talking international financial institutions and so on. You know, which is going to be so much the subject of the G20. If we really are serious about a new world order, we've got to be serious about maybe, you know, changing the way we position ourselves in the world.
Well, that new world order that Anne's referring to is, of course, the G20, where Gordon will present new nuclear plans alongside the ever-increasing number of other schemes to poor old Barack Obama when he arrives in London on the 2nd of April. Tom and I are going to do a Politics Weekly the day after. That will be on the 3rd.
Simon Hoggart, parliamentary reporter for The Guardian. One of the big stories this week has been the suggestion by Sir Liam Donaldson, the chief health officer, that there should be a minimum price for alcohol. He's not saying that the tax should necessarily go up on all alcohol, just that there should be minimum amount you have to spend to get a certain amount of alcohol. Got me? So, for example, you might say it was 50p per unit, which would mean that a bottle of wine would have to cost at least £3, since a bottle of wine contains 6 units. The effect would be to cut down on sales, it's hoped, of the really cheap stuff that's sold in supermarkets, the rot-gut wines and the lager that tastes no different from cat's urine, except cat's urine probably has more taste. And the theory is that it would stop people, teenagers and young persons generally, from getting bladdered. Well, it's really not gone down terribly well in Westminster, I think partly because very few politicians don't booze to some extent, and they're a little bit worried about what might be the reaction from the brewers, the distillers, the off-licences in their constituencies, and indeed from their constituents, who feel that just because they like a nice, quiet, relaxing drink after work, there's no reason why they should have to pay for the excessive minority, even if it's a rather noisy and vocal minority that tends to throw up on your shoes on Friday nights. Anyway, government ministers do seem, at the moment, to be opposed to it. I think they're a little bit afraid of the whole nanny state business. Has it gone a little bit too far telling us what we should eat, what we should drink and so forth? On the other hand, the smoking ban has proved to be an astonishing success. I think there's a clear difference here. Everybody who smoked wants to give up. Everybody who smokes knows it's bad for you. And I was a 60-a-day man at one time and I hated the fact. I would have been delighted if there'd been a smoking ban then, because it would have helped me give up much, much sooner. But drink's different. Very few people who like a drink want to give up. We actually rather enjoy it. We rather like the taste, at least of some drinks, perhaps not the ones that teenagers get completely wasted on at weekends, but wines, a fine real ale, a nice glass of scotch, brandy after dinner, what could be nicer? So I think the government isn't going to go down that primrose path towards banning, or at least making much more expensive, other people's pleasures. They've reckoned that this time there would be far too much of a reaction.
Mike, both of us, we sit next to Simon and we're familiar with the sound of him reading off a list of wine bottles for his recommendations in his Spectator wine column. Is it just wishful thinking on his part that the government's going to treat wine differently from, say, fags?
Well, I defend Simon's right to drink excessively to the death, and I do sometimes myself. I think he's wrong on this one. I was very pleased to see him define a bottle of wine as 6 units, because, of course, that's fantastically controversial. Some of the Puritans say, no, there are 10 units in a bottle of wine. Well, they can go take a jump. It's 6 in the white, universally recognised measurement of alcoholic content.
Which applies to red wine, too.
And Simon wouldn't drink a £3 bottle of wine if you paid him £3 for drinking it. Never mind. I think he's wrong about this, because the great balance between liberty and libertarianism and the nanny state. Simon was right to say the smoking ban's been a huge success. The libertarians hate it. They have little meetings like the Ku Klux Klan to discuss this vicious fascist government which has done it for them. But fact is, it works, and we know about the cancer link. Everybody knows it. We should have known it for 50 years, but they're still complaining. With booze, and I do not speak as a teetotaler, there's a lot of it around. It's very, very cheap. kids getting bladdered, as Simon said, at weekend. It's there's no social discipline in drink, although the health fiends are after the middle-aged housewives knocking back a bottle of wine at home in the afternoon while watching sofa television. So they're everywhere. But the fact is, we do drink foolishly in some ways, although people don't know this. We drink a lot less than we did per head 20, 30 years ago. But when you consider domestic violence, crime, rape, all the things that go with the bad side effects of the booze, and we obsess about drugs disproportionately in relation to the drink, which causes a lot more sorrow.
Anne is nodding
and
her head.
I think 50p a unit will probably come, although I didn't like Sir Liam talking about passive drinking. We know what passive smoking means. Don't spoil a good idea, Sir Liam. I never get blasted inhaling Simon Hoggart's breath. I've tried.
Cheaper. Anne, why are you shaking your head?
Well, mainly because the annoying thing about, you know, sharing a studio with Mike is he always says everything you're just planning to say just before you want to say it.
I'm longer-winded, though, Anne.
More fluent, I think I'd kindly put it.
It's the drink. It's still working through this time of morning. I was at the Irish Embassy last night.
I think the political response to the Donaldson proposal is completely crackpot. I just cannot understand it.
Normally we'll look at this, and they'd immediately, no.
You cannot go into, you know, a small town centre on a Friday or Saturday night looking forward to a kind of stroll down the high street. It's really unpleasant. That's because kids are drinking far, far, far too much. And probably my own kids do, but I don't see it. And I certainly know lots of other kids who do. And they can afford to do it. Okay, they're richer than they used to be, but drink is relatively cheaper. But what I think really was really interesting about what Donaldson was saying was the way he was saying it. And I actually do think that the passive drinking argument is an important one. And I think assessing or counting the costs of social damage is a critical way of assessing risk. And I think one reason why the politicians shied away from it is because of the implications it has for how you treat drugs as well.
Well, one of the ways the Italians have brought it down is education. So it's not legislation, or it's not even raising money. Do you think that was something, you know, like sex education classes, you can have drink education classes, it'll just be a dead end?
Well, they can be terribly cringeworthy. I mean, I've no idea how the Italians do it. I mean, it is really tricky. It does sort of challenge Bleeding Heart Liberals, of which I sort of include myself in their number. And I mean, I think Mike had it right. I mean, I suppose there clearly is a public order problem. We can have arguments about health versus freedom. There was a huge public order problem. And maybe rather than the sort of minimum supermarket price, we ought to be thinking in a much more aggressively about price in pubs and clubs. And I mean, I actually think the extension of the licensing hours, I don't mean sort of, you know, I think it's fine that people are allowed to drink in the day now. But I think, you know, we need to look, I don't want to sound too Daily Mail-like, but I think we need to look at the kind of drinking beyond 11 o'clock, because it is true. Your average small town centre in England these days is a nightmare on Friday and Saturdays.
Sarko is pushing for it to be banned from 10 till 6. Why the hell can't we? I mean, obviously, we've just reversed
it. Yeah, that it is. But I don't know about clubs. I'm not certain that it's pubs, but maybe it is this vertical drinking stuff. But it's also kids sitting in bus stops, you know, with strong lager. And
they don't have this trouble in French provincial towns on a Friday night. They're very, very boring.
But what Prime Minister White do?
Sometimes boring is good, Mike.
Yeah, I know. But they are dreadfully dull. But you do see older Frenchmen knocking off a glass of Armagnac and a beer with their croissant in the cafe at 9 in the morning, which does slightly upset me. It's just about the only thing that does in drink matters.
But I do think your point about the smoking ban was right. There is something about kind of, you know, you need to catch a wave, don't you? You need popular sentiment to build up to the level at which it's kind of capable of being there.
Blair said an interesting thing about that in some interview, like the one you had with Gordon Brown. They're not easy, these interviews, you know, it's like getting blood out of a stone. Blair said to Patrick Winter and me, the ban, I wouldn't have voted for it 10 years ago. I wouldn't have thought it was stuck, he said, but it built up through two things. One is workplaces and also the sort of health argument built up, and there was almost a consensus before we got there.
Where are we at on the idea of raising the drinking age, say, to 21? Would that be pointless, really?
Well, I just think it's morally wrong that you can let children get divorced at 17. It's the wrong way to go. It's about responsibility, not about restricting people, about engaging people to be responsible with their own lives. In America, they went back from 18 to 21. It was absolutely grotesque. And I would be, when I lived there, it would be propaganda in schools with eight-year-olds. I remember a fella telling me, when I had a second beer, you know, and American beers like Simon's Wee Wee, my little boy would grab my legs like in those Victorian paintings, Selma, no more drink to my father. No, Daddy, don't have a second beer. Of course, by the time he finds you can drink those American beers all day without feeling anything, then the next step is to think, well, maybe cocaine's not so bad. They've got a big... I think there's a connection between excessive repression and excessive counter-reaction through into drugs and things.
It is said that if you're visibly pregnant and order a glass of wine in a bar, you get arrested in America.
Well, it is my solemn responsibility to have to wrap this up. You can leave your thoughts on our programme on our politics blog. Thank you to Michael White, thank you, Anne Perkins and Will Woodward for coming on the show, and thank you very much to Francesca Panetta for producing it. Till next week, when Tom is back, goodbye.